Well, let's come to our...
Not quite order yet. We're still short a few members for a quorum. Today is... is this the last of our oversights? Getting close to it. Today we're talking about the Department of Health. I've asked Chair Huntley if he's willing to carry on this discussion, and he graciously allowed that. When we get our quorum, we'll do the minutes. He might do that. Study group that's evolved, and don't worry, most of you aren't on it. There's been a big push by the counties and those who work in the eligibility arena to try to simplify medical assistance eligibility stuff, and so there's a group about that. Senator Sharon approached me wanting to work on it in the Senate, and so it's going to be actually a bicameral study group, so we've moved one more notch. Representative Huntley, how about that? the virus of study groups is spreading across the street, and so this will include Senator Sharon, Representative Grunhagen, and Representative Loeffler, who will dig in on this and hopefully come up with some way to do that. There's been, and staff is going to be Christine. Now we're officially here. So Christine will be staffing that, and so the counties are interested in that. I know Portico is interested. Some other people that are interested in that would like to get a hold of those folks. Christine will coordinate getting you together. And just to advise the people who are on those study groups, which is most of you, and I think everybody's on one or the other, please be working on those. We have a window of several weeks and not months to come up with some kind of a... At the very least, you'll learn a lot, but hopefully you'll come up with some ideas about how to streamline things and how to focus our resources to get more... to get consistent client outcomes and services accomplished. Staff will not be at all of those. I'm just making sure they know that because there's just not enough hours in the Christine's and Holly's day to do all those. But she can coordinate department help. She can get you a room. You can be in your office if you want. These are unofficial, not public meetings, although the public is welcome to come if you want to invite them to talk about things. So anyway, that's the newest. There's one of these sheets at the table for people who want to get the full list. Representative Murphy never had a chance to do minutes yet this year, so would this be kind of like a day worth coming for?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes.
Well, thank you. In a bipartisan spirit here, I'm going to turn the gavel to Representative Huntley, who will take the vote on this very important matter, and then and then he'll chair the rest of the meeting as we look at the Department of Health. So, Representative Huntley.
All those in favor of approving the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So the minutes are approved, and now we're going to get an overview from the Health Department for this committee. We have four people signed up. We're going to start with Dr. Ellinger, who is the new commissioner of health, and been there what, second week? No,
in my second week, I think the seventh day. Well, Representative Huntley, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to come before you. I am Dr. Ed Ellinger. I'm the commissioner of health, the Minnesota Department of Health. And a couple of days ago, we did present an overview of the department to the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. And I'm not going to go through all of that presentation, but I do want to just highlight a couple of the things that we talked about at that, because it does set the stage for the budget presentation that you'll be seeing today from the staff that have come along with us. And I do want to, you know, start out with this quotation that I like to use because it really highlights the importance of health in our overall society, that everything that happens in the state really requires people to be healthy. Because when health is absent, wisdom can't reveal itself, art cannot become manifest, strength cannot fight, wealth becomes useless, and intelligence cannot be applied. All of these characteristics of our state really need to have a healthy population in order to move forward. And this has been recognized since... for a couple of thousand years, this quotation is from 335 BCE. So And I also want to point out the fact that when we look at health, there's several different ways of looking at health. And this is one of the ways we look at health in terms of the causes of death, the top 10 leading causes of death. And certainly at Minnesota Department of Health, we look at these causes of death. We have programs related to heart disease, cancer, stroke, unintentional injuries, diabetes. All of these things are major contributors to health in our community, in our state. And these are issues that we focus a lot of our attention on. But we also focus on what's upstream. That's one of the things about public health. It doesn't just look at once people get the illnesses or injuries or the diseases. We really look upstream and find out what's causing these things in the first place. So we also, with a lot of our programs, with a lot of our efforts, we go upstream and look at the what we consider the real causes of death, the precipitating causes of injury and illness, tobacco use, diet, inactivity, alcohol use, toxic agents, motor vehicles, sexual behavior, drug use. All of these things, they don't get reflected on death certificates when somebody dies, but we know that 400,000, over 400,000 people in our society die each year because of the use of tobacco. So we really focus on a lot of that. And our efforts relate to some of these major initiatives, public health initiatives that have contributed to the health improvement in our country and in our state. Certainly vaccination, motor vehicle safety, things, engineering that really causes us to be much safer in our society. Infectious diseases, fluoridated water, healthier foods, all of these things are part of the portfolio of public health, along with the portfolio of many other agencies that we partner with. And if we look at what goes on, we look at all of the areas that influence health, and environmental exposures, social circumstances, our genetic predisposition, behavior, and healthcare. And the Department of Health has activities in each of these areas. We really have programs that focus on these contributors to our health in various ways, shapes, or forms. We will deal with each one of those little characteristics. And we do that by focusing with the healthcare, as we see it, the healthcare system in our society, which is medical care, which is the clinical preventive services, that the individual preventive activities that go on with individuals, and then with the community health services, the environmental health, the disease prevention, the education that goes on with that. And we partner with lots of other institutions, lots of other agencies, lots of other organizations, because we know that education and economics and housing and transportation all impact health, which we really want to have the healthiest population possible. And I'll end my little piece with this fact, that the fact that we know that behavior, social circumstances, make the biggest impact on health, and medical care really is only about 10% of the factors influencing health. We know that from looking at what dollars get spent, about 97% of all health dollars go to medical care. And less than 3%, 1 to 3%, actually goes to prevention, which means that the dollars that come through the Minnesota Department of Health in that smaller portion of the overall amount of dollars that get spent in our society really go to all of those things that really focus on the real causes of death, that really focus on the major contributors to death and disability in our society, so that the small amount of dollars that goes to public health are incredibly important dollars. And we're going to be making the case that these are really important dollars if we're going to have a healthy state, and if Minnesota is going to continue to have a population where health can help art and strength and intelligence and business and education really bloom in this state. And with that, I'm going to turn over to the next part to Barb Julik, who's our Chief Financial Officer, to walk through some of the budget issues that we are facing.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Julik.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Barb Julik, and I am the CFO at the Department of Health. I'll go through a number of slides, taking a pretty deep view of the department's budget. As you can see from the first slide, the department has a little over $1 billion in their fiscal year 12 and 13 budget. The majority of these funds are federal funds, or about 46%. And it's important to note that for some federal grants, there is a match or maintenance of effort requirement. These requirements are different for each grant, and they're not on every grant. And as an example, for fiscal year 11, we received about $250 million of general fund grants, of which there is match or maintenance of effort requirements of around $31 million that we need to maintain in order to pull down that federal money. The department gets a variety of other funds. The next largest is the MERC funds, which we'll go into a little bit later. But the general fund is only about 14% of our overall budget. The next area, state government special revenue funds. These are fee-based programs, about 8% of our budget. Miscellaneous special revenue, these are donated or private grant funds, about 11% of our budget. And then finally, the healthcare access fund and the TANF funds are two direct appropriated funds that represent about 2% each of the department's budget. Again, continuing to look at the overall view of the department, about 58% of the budget is passed through to local governments, tribal governments, and community-based organizations. And the remaining 42% is for department-based activities. These activities include a number of monitoring, investigation, regulation, and oversight programs. Looking at that same split, but just for the general fund, about 64% of our general fund budget, or $98 million of the $152 million, is for pass-through grants, and about 36% is for MDH-based activities. Our budget is broke down into four program areas. Community, family, health, and promotion is the largest area, and this is the area where you would find the Women, Infants, and Children's Program, which is our largest federal grant. The other three areas include policy, quality, and compliance, health protection, and administrative support. Using those same four areas, but looking at just the general fund, again, the largest area is community, family, health. This is the area that houses the community health, local public health grants, which is our largest general funded grant. Now I'll start diving down into each of those areas by fund and by activity. So looking at the community family health program budget, you can see about 74% of their budget is statutory appropriations, the majority being federally funded, and about 26% is directly appropriated by the legislature. The largest appropriation is from the federal funds. These federal funds provide nutrition information and supplemental foods, promote family health and self-sufficiency, provide services to low-income, high-risk mothers and children, pre-pregnancy planning, and cancer screening. Again, the largest federal grant is the WIC program at about $270 million for the biennium. This program provides supplemental food and nutritional services to over 140,000 low-income pregnant women and children in Minnesota. The state government special revenue funds for this area are used for newborn screening follow-up activities to link families to appropriate services and resources to improve long-term outcomes, and the Minnesota Enable program, which stands for Education Now and Babies Later, which is a program to reduce teen pregnancy through abstinence education and other youth development activities. The healthcare access funds are used for the development and implementation of the healthcare homes, which was part of the 2008 healthcare reform legislation. In the following slides, I'll get deeper into the general fund and the TANF funds, which have a number of activities under them. But again, just looking at that overall picture in community family health, about 80% of the activities is passed through to community grants, and about 20% is maintained for department activities. And again, looking at just the general fund, the ratio is 85% for grants and about 15% for MDH-based activities. Diving into the general fund grants in this area, you can see the largest grant is for the Local Public Act funding. These grants go to community health boards and American tribal governments. These aid these local community boards in developing and maintaining a system of community health services under local administration. Next grant is family planning grants. These grants provide pre-pregnancy family planning services to high-risk, low-income individuals. Funding in this area provides services to over 29,000 at-risk individuals. Tobacco use prevention grants are aimed at reducing youth tobacco use. These are competitive grants to government, nonprofit, and nonprofit entities. The next grants are disparities grants. These are also competitive grants aimed at improving the health of poor minority racial ethnic groups that include American Indians, Asian Americans, African Americans, and Latino Hispanics. These grants focus on 7 health priorities of infant mortality, immunization, breast and cervical cancer, HIV, AIDS, and STD, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and injury and violence. The next grant is a positive alternative grants. These grants provide support, encouragement, and assistance to pregnant women. Fetal alcohol grants. These grants provide prevention and intervention services to fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. The grantee is a statewide nonprofit organization that by law goes to this one grantee. Poison Information Center grants provides resources to identify appropriate home management or referral of cases of human poisoning. Cancer control grants provide breast and cervical cancer screening, diagnostic, and follow-up services. The grantees are private and community clinics, healthcare providers, and community health boards. And with these funds, this program screens around 20,000 low-income women, and in 2009 identified 163 cancers. Other grants, there are a variety of other smaller grants. This includes a suicide prevention grant, the Hearing Aid Loan Bank grant that supports statewide hearing aid and instrument loan banks to families with children of newly diagnosed hearing loss, Minnesota Children with Special Health Care Needs, which provides specialty diagnostic services for the underserved regions of the state, and support grants for families with deaf children, which provides parent-to-parent support for families with young children who are deaf or have a hearing loss.
Hi, Ms. Julek. Representative Abler has a question.
Hi. Welcome back. Just dusting off my memories now that I have a different job to do here. In the past, a lot of these grants have been small and have been quite burdensome for the different counties or nonprofits to apply for. Has that improved since I asked this question 8 years ago? Or is it still, I just don't remember what's happened since then.
Mr. Chair, I believe around 8 years ago, we took a number of smaller grants and combined them into the local public health grant funding. And so I don't remember what number it was, but that those have all been combined into this local public health grant. So that's that $48.9 million slice.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Abler,
and Ms. Julek, and we can discuss it more later. But are the other ones that are left, are they pretty good size and they're worth applying for in general? And I know you track them pretty tightly on some of the outcomes. Has that been thought has gone forward? It sounds like I'm glad I remembered the topic. So things have gotten better.
I'm not aware of any issues with people applying for these grants.
All right,
we could.
And Ms. Julek, the tobacco prevention grants, how does that fit in with the SHIP program?
I think I'll ask the director, Pat Adams, to answer that.
And is there coordination between the
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Pat Adams. I'm the director of the statewide office of health improvement initiatives. There is definite coordination of tobacco grants and SHIP. The statewide health improvement grant, SHIP, targets policy systems and environmental change that can support tobacco cessation, whereas our tobacco prevention control grant is actually targeting our most high-risk population. For example, teens who are in juvenile centers, just teens in general, and other high-risk populations. So it's a very targeted approach to use of those dollars, as opposed to the SHIP dollars, which are statewide and at a higher level in terms of systems change.
Thank you. Ms. Julek.
All right. Now we'll look at the MDH-based activities for this program area, and again, there's a number here. Starting at the top with the chronic disease and environmental epidemiology, this area tracks the occurrence of work-related injuries and disease and collects demographics and diagnostic information on newly diagnosed cancers. In 2007, this area tracked over 25,000 newly diagnosed invasive cancers that were identified. The Cancer Control Area supports the federally funded SAGE program, which provides funding for cancer screening activities. Other health promotion and chronic disease activities includes oversight and medical direction of the division, grants management and support activities that work to improve the health and prevent injury and chronic disease, This area provides training for people across the state on how to implement community-based evidence chronic disease management programs. The next area, minority and multicultural health. This provides the operation of this Office of Minority and Multicultural Health, which works collaboratively with other divisions in the department, other state departments, and community-based organizations and health plans to eliminate health disparities and identify and promote best practices to improve the health of racial minorities and ethnic groups. The next area is maternal and child health. This group provides state leadership around the maternal and child health issues, including staffing the statutory directed maternal and child health advisory task force. Minnesota Children with Special Health Needs provides coordination of resources for children and youth with special health needs and their families. Through this coordination, services to over 7,000 children with special health care needs are met. The Birth Defects Information System. This provides for the development and implementation of the Birth Defects Information System to monitor trends on birth defects. And finally, other activities in this area include general administration and fiscal oversight. It also includes women's right to know activities, training and consultant for child and teen checkup, and grant administration for a variety of grants.
Okay.
Looking at the TANF activities funded in this program, we have about $23 million in the base budget for TANF. All of it is appropriated or aligned with this program. About $22 million is for grants. The major grant is home visiting. These grants go to both the local public health and to tribal organizations. These grants promote family health, self-sufficiency, and school readiness. Another grant here is family planning, and along with the general fund, these grants provide pre-pregnancy family planning services to high-risk, low-income individuals.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flowick.
I just have a question about the family home visiting grants. Did you get a major federal grant, and is that part of the chart?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flowick, yes, we did receive a federal grant last summer, I believe, for home visiting.
How big was that, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it sounds like it's around 1.7, but we will follow up and get the exact number for you.
1.7 million? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, Ms. Julik. The whole visiting idea, lots of other agencies make visits as well. Counties do it, schools, and other groups that nonprofits, Head Start, I think, does some. It seems to me like there's a way to coordinate this better to get more benefit, not to discuss today, but it's just in my head that if we could get a lead agency to look after these families, that everybody knows these families. They all get the same visits by different people, and the thought was at one point, oh, if we can just get them a home visit, we'll help them, but now they have four, and the last one's kind of annoying to them, you know, in times when our resources are lean. So that's just a thought to put into your heads as we look at this. I don't have an answer, but
Mr. Chair, we can certainly work with you and look at this. We want to ensure that those home visits included a public health aspect to them in doing that.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
But also in terms of the focus of what we're trying to get out of it, you know, the whole silo of now this is an education visit and this is a...
Correct.
This is your checkup from your health thing visit, and now we're going to do the whatever public health visit we're going to do. And so it's just for probably public discussion to figure out how best to do it. I think we need to somehow.
Thanks. For the newer members, most of the TANF money is in the Human Services Department. Just a small portion is in the Health Department.
Correct.
So, Ms. Julie. Continue.
And again, I'll remind you, these numbers are biennial numbers, so they're a two-year figure as we go through. And the last area here, $1.5 million for other activities. This includes the evaluation and training aspects of the program that we're required by statute to provide for home visiting, evaluation, and training. Then I will move on to the next area of the department, which is policy, quality, and compliance. This has an all-funds budget of about $289 million. The majority... about 75% of these funds are statutorily appropriated and about 25% are directly appropriated by the legislature. The largest appropriation in this area is from the MERC Fund, which stands for Medical Education and Research Cost. This is a grant program that primarily funds clinical health professional training institutions, and I'll go over a little more detail in future slides on some revenue sources and where those fundings go. Federal funds are about 4% of this budget, and it includes grants for electronic health, small and rural hospitals, oral health, rural health, health provider loan programs, and data collection and analysis activities. Miscellaneous special revenue fund is about 18% of this budget area. The majority of that is technical, how we carry out our health facility certification, where we will pull our Medicare, Medicaid, our fee-based programs, and our general fund programs into a pool to do health facility license and certification, so it operates out of that special revenue fund. And then I will go into more depth on the general fund, health care access fund, and state government special revenue funds, which are the direct appropriated funds. But again, looking at kind of that big picture again, about 66% of all the funds in this area go out through grants, with, again, MERC being the largest one, and 34% being MDH-based activities. And looking at just the general fund, that ratio changes a bit, where it's about 50% apiece.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted, if I could, before we get too far ahead here, just to actually weigh in on the visits, on the home visits, because I come from greater Minnesota out in the country, and I had a constituent last year with a child who could not get to Head Start because the bus only came so far. We tried everything. Of course, a cab would be outrageous, the cost. The parents did not have the transportation. The father took the car, the only vehicle, to work. And so they were isolated. And I just wanted to make that point here, to your point, Representative Abler, that I would like to give some thought about the visits, the four visits that come to the homes, that actually it's economically more feasible for people to come to us sometimes than for us to get to them, especially in greater Minnesota where transportation is a problem.
Now, I would just comment about the medical education funding. That goes primarily to residency programs to help support the residency programs, and most of that money goes through hospitals, and there's all kinds of other things in the human service budget that relate to the same area, so it's a very complex relationship between this money and the money in the Human Services Department.
All right. Using the same format, looking at the general fund grants piece for the 12-13 biennium. Starting on the lower left-hand side, the rural hospital and capital improvement grants, about $3.5 million for the biennium. These grants are used to update, remodel, or replace aging hospital facilities and equipment to maintain the operations of small rural hospitals. Grantees include rural hospitals with up to 50 or fewer beds. Federally Qualified Health Centers, or FQHC grants, support Minnesota's Federally Qualified Health Centers to continue and improve services to populations with low incomes. Community Clinic Grants. These grants assist clients to serve low-income populations, reduce uncompensated care burdens, or improve care delivery infrastructure. The Comprehensive Advanced Life Support System. This supports training for rural medical personnel, including physicians, assistants, nurses, and allied health providers. Indian Health Grants provide health service assistance to Native Americans who reside off the reservation. Loan Forgiveness provides health education loan forgiveness for physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants in rural and urban underserved areas. And finally, migrant grants provide subsidized health services to migrant workers and their families. Looking at the MDH-based activities in this area, you'll see that about half the funds are used as the required state match for the health facility licensing and certification and case mix reviews. These general fund dollars are transferred and pooled with state government special revenue fee funds, federal Medicare and Medicaid dollars for the health facility certification activities. Staff here are responsible for assuring the quality and of care and quality of life for vulnerable individuals receiving services from state licensed or federally certified health care providers. This includes monitoring over 8,000 health care facilities and providers for safety and quality. Other compliance monitoring activities include an occupational analysis review and complaint investigations on unlicensed complementary and alternative health care practitioners. The final area in this includes our healthcare policy division, which does a number of activities, including operating a healthcare statistics unit to analyze vital records. They produce an annual summary of health statistics, both statewide and by county, and report on health disparities for populations of color.
Ms. Julek, the health facility licensing, does that include nursing homes?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, for the newer members, the health department actually looks at the quality of health care that's being delivered in nursing homes, and the human service department goes into nursing homes and looks at the financial aspects and whether people are coded at the appropriate level for the services.
Mr. Chair, members, actually the health department does case mix review, which is part of that analysis.
So what does the human services do there in nursing homes?
I think they, Mr. Chair, I believe they take that information and that's how they calculate what should be paid for the,
okay,
the residents.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. It's like the old days, isn't it? Anyway, just a comment. Representative Fritz, on that home visiting thing, you know, it's so productive having a wide range of us here. When I was thinking about my comments, I was thinking about what it looks like in kind of a suburban metro thing, and I never even dawned on me about the how do you get there question. So it's that's just helpful, I think. On the and the other question I have is that alternative in the 146A oversight, is that still a funded position?
For the unlicensed?
Right.
Yes, Mr. Chair. It was originally unallotted, and then it was brought back.
Reallotted.
Okay. Reallotted.
Okay.
So, yes, it is a funded
position. One position? Or
I think it's less than one position.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Slawick's next, and then Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, just since we're going back to comments, you know, when we say things like, we all know who those families are, my son, when he was diagnosed with autism, we had a home visit. From the school came out and visited our home, and we're, you know, middle class to probably one of the nicest neighborhoods in Maplewood. So we always have to remember that we are those families. I mean, it's legislators. Okay.
Representative, let me apologize. I didn't mean it that way, but I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and changing the topic, but also going back just a little bit. It's so interesting to go through this way because even though I've been on this committee for a long time, I still see things I didn't see before, and this is pretty complicated budgeting. But on the slide, you had this Rural Hospital Capital Improvement Fund, $3.5 million. And I'm just kind of curious about that because when I look at this whole pie, and I gather those are general fund, that's general fund money. And one of the things that interests me also in that pie is the loan forgiveness piece, because I'm really interested in our future in terms of having enough practitioners to provide service, especially in rural areas, and, you know, loan forgiveness is a big piece of that. So I'm wondering, you know, we've got this pot of money, I guess, that supports rural hospitals doing capital improvements, which is something I wasn't aware of before, and I'd like a little more information about that. Is that something that, you know, is that a pot of money that we appropriate in every budget? Is it, how is it distributed? What are the criteria? Because I'm, you know, as we're looking to, you know, figure out how to make the best use, I mean, obviously that's, by the name, it's supporting rural hospitals, but so is having enough practitioners to practice in the rural areas. So I don't know if maybe you could send me some information if you don't have it right now.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to send information to the committee. All right. Mr. Chair, continuing on with the administrative functions of this area, we were in the health policy pie piece. We talked about healthcare statistics being in here. This also includes the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, which we use to monitor state-level trends in chronic disease, health risk behavior, and preventive behavior prevalence. This also includes a statewide trauma system, which is a comprehensive designation process for trauma hospitals throughout the state. Costs for the trauma systems are offset by a general fund fee. This also includes where we support the use of electronic health records. With this support, electronic transactions by more than 60,000 providers in Minnesota have reduced healthcare administrative costs across the state. This also includes activities around women's right to know data collection and reporting statutory requirements and the Administrative Uniformity Committee. Mr. Chair, members, now we get into the complicated part. The next two slides, we'll go into the basic of the MERC funding, and I think later on in the presentation, we'll have some more details on MERC, but this will just kind of give you a picture of where the funding comes from. The majority of the funding comes from the Department of Human Services Prepaid Medical Assistance Program carve-out, and that's the two big slides, the PMAP carve-out and the PMAP add-on. What happens here is within the DHS rates that goes to prepaid health plans for medical assistance recipients, a portion is carved out, and this includes 50% state money and 50% federal money, and that portion is carved out and then sent to the Department of Health for the MERC fund. There are two other sources of revenue here. There is a cigarette tax revenue, which is about $8.5 million a year, that is dedicated to the health department. So this is a portion of the current cigarette tax that just gets peeled out for the health department. And then we get federal match on some of our activities, and that comes to the health department as we earn that federal match.
Ms. Julek, on that, those PMAP dollars that you're carving out, does that include the federal match, or is that just the state fund?
Mr. Chair, members, it includes the federal match. So of that $99 million in the carve-out, about half is state, half is federal. Of the $43 million in the add-on, about half is state, half is federal.
Thank you. Continue.
And I'll just mention that on the PMAP carve-out, the state share comes from the Department of Human Services MA budget. On the add-on, the state share comes from the University of Minnesota, just to make things more complex. The uses of the fund.
If I could just comment to some of the newer members, we do all sorts of what you might think are strange things.
Refinancing.
To try to capture as many federal dollars as we can. And that's what some of this is a way to, the feds pay, other than the stimulus period, they pay 50% of what we pay. And so if we can arrange the money in a way that feds will match it, that's good for our budget.
Mr. Chair, looking at the uses of the MERC funds, where does the money go? Again, this was about $169 million of revenue that comes in, and $169 goes out. The biggest piece of that is distributed through a general distribution formula. This formula, about $57 million per year, or about $114 million for the biennium, is distributed. I think we'll get into the distribution factors later on in the presentation. The next largest piece of the pie is repayment of $39 million back to the U of M. The source of this is the PMAP add-on. And I'll just mention the source of the general distribution formula is a variety of sources. It's the carve-out, it's a portion of the cigarette tax, and then a federal share on that cigarette tax portion. Direct grants, about $5.3 million a year, or $10.7 million for the biennium, go to three institutions. University Medical Center at Fairview gets about $1.5 million, the U of M Dental School about $2 million, and the Academic Health Center $1.8 million. The source of these payments is the cigarette tax and a small federal match on that, about $700,000 in federal match. And then there's two innovation programs out of this fund. There's a grant to Hennepin County Medical Center, and then there's a dental innovation grant. These dental innovation grants support innovative dental clinical training for dental professionals and programs which increase access to dental care for underserved populations. And the source of these payments is the PMAP add-on. Finally, there's a small administrative use in these funds to manage the entire MERC program, and the source of that is that dedicated cigarette tax.
Representative Abler.
Sorry, I have so many questions. That dental innovation money, is that used for that dental therapist program to enhance that at all, the new one we just did a couple of years ago?
Mr. Chair, no. You'll see that further. Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, you'll see that further in the slides. It's funded out of the state government special revenue
fund. Thank you.
And again, Mr. Chair, we'll have more detail on Merck further on in the presentation. The next area in policy and quality, or actually, I'll go on to the Healthcare Access Fund. Most of the funding that we get from the Healthcare Access Fund goes to policy, quality, and compliance. About 20% is for pass-through grants, and about 80% is for MDH-based activities. Looking at the grants, you'll see a number of grants mirroring some of the general fund grants. In here, starting at the left-hand side, we have a loan forgiveness program. So again, along with the general fund, we provide loan forgiveness grants out of the Healthcare Access Fund. You'll see again the federally qualified health centers. So again, along with the general fund, we provide funding here to support the federally qualified health centers to serve low-income populations. I will just note that this amount here is one time in fiscal year 12 only and then goes away.
If I could just again, for the newer members, the Healthcare Access Fund is based primarily on two taxes. One is a 2% provider tax that most of you have heard about. And then there's an HMO tax?
Mr. Chair, I believe. Premium tax. The premium tax.
Premium tax, right. Premium tax. And again, most of that money is spent through the Department of Human Services to run the Minnesota Care Program, but some of those dollars are transferred to the Department of Health to do these particular programs.
Mm-hmm. Continuing on, Mr. Chair, we have some rural hospital grants. These grants assist with strategic planning and transition projects for rural hospitals with fewer than 50 beds. There's a summer internship program for high school and college students. Grantees include nonprofit organizations representing health facilities. There are community clinic grants. These grants assist nonprofit community clinics to serve low-income populations, reduce uncompensated care burdens, and improve care delivery infrastructure. There is a health and long-term care career promotion grant. This helps to develop and implement health and long-term care career curriculums. And then there's two other grants. First is a donated dental service grant. This grant provides funding for administrative support of the donated dental program, which provides services to low-income and uninsured recipients. And the other grant in this other area is a grant to provide a state match for a federal National Health Service Corps grant, which is for health education loan forgiveness for physicians in rural and underserved urban areas.
And Ms. Julek, where is the SHIP money that comes out of the Healthcare Access Fund?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. The SHIP money is part of the fiscal year 10-11 Healthcare Access Fund and sunsets at the end of 11, so it is not shown as part of this presentation. For reference, in fiscal 11, the department received $27 million in SHIP. Mr. Chair, continuing on, looking at the administrative side of the Healthcare Access Fund, the majority of these activities are in the policy, quality, and compliance area. Starting in the bottom left-hand corner under healthcare transformation, these activities, or funding from this, came from the 2008 healthcare reform bill. Funding is one time through fiscal year 2012, so it will sunset after that. These activities in this area are to manage the implementation of quality, transparency, and payment reform components of that 2008 reform bill. Next area is health economics. This conducts research and analysis to monitor changes in Minnesota healthcare marketplace, to understand factors influencing healthcare costs, quality, and access, and to support the development of healthcare policy in Minnesota. There's a data and project initiative. This involves the collection and management of healthcare data, which provides the basis for the health economics research. The Office of Rural Health and Primary Care administers the rural grant programs in the department and staffs the Rural Health Advisory Committee, which provides health professional recruitment, retention, and practice management assistance for rural and underserved urban safety net areas. And then there's another healthcare policy area. This includes funding for the Healthcare Access Survey, which is done every other year, that provides information on health insurance coverage in Minnesota, the factors influencing the changes in coverage, and the disparities by race, ethnicity, geography, and other factors. This area also includes Information Clearinghouse, which serves as a single point of entry for consumers seeking information about health insurance. And the one slice of the pie I skipped over was the, the next slice is the healthcare homes. And this actually operates out of Community Family Health, and this provides for the development and implementation of the healthcare homes as part of the 2008 reform bill.
Representative Abler.
Hi. I appreciate all this information. Just for the new commissioners, understanding the source of money for this pot is $150 million in deficit for this, for the 12-13 biennium. So it would be productive, I think, if I could know something more about some of those. Not for today, but just to look at those.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, we'll be happy to.
We have our hands so full. The surprises are never good anymore.
All right, the last funding area for policy, quality, and compliance is a number of state government special revenue programs. This is about $28 million for the biennium. These are mostly fee programs operated in this area. The biggest area, the bottom half of the pie chart, includes facility licensing and certification and vulnerable adults. Under the vulnerable adults, these staff investigate reports of maltreatment in accordance with the Vulnerable Adults Act and other complaints of abuse, neglect, or maltreatment in licensed healthcare facilities. The staff also review requests for set-asides of criminal maltreatment incidents for individuals who are requesting to work in licensed healthcare facilities. The facility licensing and certification, we've discussed this already. This is the state government special revenue portion of that. We combine this money with the general fund portion and with Medicare and Medicaid to provide facility licensing and certification. A couple things to note in this area. This area conducts over 136,000 background checks for persons seeking employment in healthcare facilities, and it also maintains the nursing home report card on the website, which has been visited by over 360,000 hits in the last few years. Continuing around clockwise to professional licensing and regulation, this house's licensing, certification, credentialing, and regulatory oversight for morticians, occupational therapists, speech language pathologists, audiologists, hearing aid dispensers, interpretive services, and the doula registry. This area has inspected over 350 funeral home establishments and licensed over 1,300 morticians in an annual basis. It also maintains a registry of over 60,000 nursing assistants and includes the registration of temporary employment of nurses. The managed care section monitors 8 HMOs and 3 county-based organizations that provide health care to over 1 million Minnesotans. Activities here include ongoing monitoring for compliance, quality, and financial examination, complaint investigation, and review and analysis of annual reports. The state registrar provides registration of all birth and death certificates. On an annual basis, it will issue over 600,000 birth and death certificates in the state.
Again, for the newer members, the Department of Health oversees HMOs, whereas the Department of Commerce oversees most of the other kinds of insurance policies.
Mr. Chair, a couple more slices here. The adverse reporting. This is a reporting system through which Minnesota hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers report whenever one of 28 serious adverse health events occurs. I believe the most recent report came out in the last week. The Father's Adoption Registry facilitates adoptions of newborns in the state while protecting parent rights. And then two grants fall into the other activities. This is where the assessing dental therapist falls in. This is a two-year appropriation that ends in fiscal year 13 to provide support to assess the impact of the Advanced Dental Therapist Program. And this is also where the electronic health federal compliance activity is, which has oversight of health information exchange and requires health information organizers and health data intermediaries to obtain certificates of authority. Moving on to the third area, our third bureau is health protection. This has a biennial budget of $224 million. About 65% is statutorily appropriated and 35% is directly appropriated. Federal funds in this area includes grants for safe drinking water, various lead protection and reduction programs, biomonitoring, immunizations, and vaccines for children, TB, AIDS, HIV, STD surveillance, and prevention, lab capacity, emerging infections, and emergency and hospital preparedness grants. Looking at the split of all funds, about 20% of the funding is passed through the grants, while 80% of the funding is MDH-based activity. And then looking at that ratio just in the general fund, about the same split, 23% for grants and about 77% for MDH-based activity. Diving into the general fund grants, there are four grants in this bureau, the largest of which on the left-hand side is the AIDS program. This provides health education, risk reduction, behavioral intervention, and AIDS HIV testing for high-risk and HIV-positive individuals. Grantees include community-based organizations and clinics. Based on this funding, clinics provide testing for 30,000 people with STDs and 12,000 with HIV, and more than 2,300 infected persons are treated annually. The refugee and TB grants are part of our disparities program. These outreach grants are for health screening and TB case management for case management services. The TB medication and outreach funds grants for medication for TB infected persons. And finally, the lead services grants provides lead training to workers and property owners and lead cleaning services in housing with elevated blood lead levels in children. Moving to the general fund administration of our programs, this is about $14.4 million for the biennium and funds a variety of things, the biggest of which on the right-hand side of the slide is the public health lab. This provides funding for critical lab work that's not funding with other resources. This provides lab supplies for testing of conditions of public health importance that aren't funded with specific grants. The general fund supports the lab preparedness and other responses to environmental spills, industrial accidents, and other emergencies that cannot be charged to other funding sources. This may include chemical analysis of trucker spills, contaminated water runoff from fighting fires, abandoned drums of industrial solvent, unlicensed radioactive sources, and suspicious powders. This area annually performs about 70,000 clinical tests for infectious disease and food and waterborne illness outbreaks. And about 44,000 samples of water, soil, and air are tested for potential health threats in any given year. Emergency preparedness has a small general fund appropriation, but most of their activities are funded with federal funds. The general fund activity supports continuation of operational planning and preparedness, but overall this area coordinates the department's response for emergencies, including natural disasters such as flood and the recent H1N1 pandemic. This includes relocation for natural disasters. This may include relocation of residents from long-term care facilities and ensuring communication systems such as the Health Alert Network are in place, which allows for time-sensitive communications on health-related issues.
If I could comment, Dr. Ellinger, in the policy committee, had a chart that showed the life expectancy of U.S. people versus the years, and there was a big dip of like 15-20% in 1918, which was due to the influenza. And the Ms. Julek has just talked about emergency preparedness. We have developed a lot of things to make sure that that does not happen again. And it may never happen, but if it does, Minnesota is well prepared. I don't know if Dr. Ellinger, you look like you want to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a good reminder of the preparedness, but it's also a good reminder that people should get their flu shots. And there's still time in this flu season.
Commercial paid for. I see a show of hands. Culprits would offer.
Ms. Julek.
Mr. Chair, continuing on, the next slice is environmental health management and other services. This is our food safety program. This provides education to the public, local health departments, nonprofit organizations, the industry, and other state and federal agencies and schools on food safety. Moving around, on the bottom left is the indoor environmental quality. This area responds to inquiries and complaints regarding indoor air quality, including radon, carbon monoxide, mold, and providing assistance on indoor air issues such as issues to the public, to local health departments, to nonprofit organizations, and other state and federal agencies and schools. In addition, this program provides lead risk assessment activities in 82 of the 87 counties where a child is identified as having an elevated blood lead level. The next slice is the environmental surveillance and assessment. This program conducts the environmental health risk assessment so that environmental hazards are assessed using sound science. This program uses the resulting assessment to offer consultation, recommended risk reduction actions, take public health action, and communicate risk information. The next slice is the infectious disease prevention and control. Other activities is the overall management of that division of infectious disease epidemiology and prevention, and it also is where the state epidemiologist is funded. The next slice is the immunization, tuberculosis, and international health unit. This funds the management and oversight of the tuberculosis program and the tuberculosis management contract to provide TB medications for persons with TB disease or infections who are residing in Minnesota. It also manages the refugee health outreach and medication distribution program. In 2009, this area managed the treatment of 161 TB cases and evaluated around 900 case contacts for TB. The acute disease infection and control area. This funds our foodborne illness hotline and food safety programs and disease investigation staff. In 2009, this area investigated over 60 intestinal disease outbreaks and detected state and national outbreaks such as E. coli and salmonella with the peanut butter and eggshells.
Ms. Julek, is that the area that's looking at the milk that has salmonella in it? Or is that FDA do that? Or Ag Department do that?
Mr. Chair, we work with Ag on that. The last piece of the pie in this one is our STD HIV section, which manages the grants in that area and also provides for disease investigation and surveillance of that area. Continuing on health protection, this is one of our larger programs for the state government special revenue fund. It has a little over $61 million for the biennium in state government. We operate a number of fee programs, starting on the lower left-hand side with the drinking water protection program. This helps the department meet the primary requirements of the Safe Drinking Water Act and also provides plan review of all new additions to the public health or to the public water supply system. This area tests over 8,000 community water systems on an annual basis. Newborn screening screens around 70,000 newborns every year for 54 rare heritable and congenital disorders and ensures that appropriate follow-up medical services are provided. The Food, Beverage, Lodging, and Certification Program provides license, inspection, and plan review for regulated establishments, provides oversight, training, and education services for local and state environmental health services programs. This area certifies over 11,000 food managers at food establishments annually. The Well Management Program, this protects drinking water and groundwater by assuring that all wells and borings are properly sited, constructed, and ultimately sealed when their useful life is over. The X-ray equipment program supports an education, technical assistance, and compliance program for licensed facilities to protect the public from receiving unnecessary exposure to ionizing radiation. The pool safety program provides licensing, plan review, and inspection for public swimming pools. The radioactive materials program supports an educational, technical assistance, and compliance program to promote and protect radiological health and safety to the public, to licensed facility staff, etc. The lab accreditation program. This program accredits 145 public and private environmental labs to assure quality. This area also provides technical consultation and training. Hospitality provides oversight training on educational services for local and state environmental health services programs to ensure a consistent approach in the regulation of food, beverage, lodging, pools, and manufactured home parks. This area licenses over 21,000 hotels and restaurants. Other programs, there are a number of other programs, including lead abatement, asbestos abatement, HIV-infected healthcare workers, and a specimen fee program in the lab.
Representative Franson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure which, if this would go to you, Ms. Ellen, or Ms. Julek, or Commissioner Ellinger, but I am curious about the lawsuit that the nine families have against the state for storage, use, and sharing of the newborn DNA.
Mr. Chair, Representative Unger, ask Assistant Commissioner Stein to.
Thank you. I'm wondering how much that's costing the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, my name is John Stein, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Health for the Health Protection Bureau. I don't have a current number on what we've expended on legal defense on that case yet. I can get that information for you.
How much has it cost the state so far, though, to store the newborn's DNA?
I also will have to get that information, Mr. Chair. I don't have the current details on the storage costs on an annual basis. We can identify that information.
Okay.
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on the same line. Do we have arrangements with the researchers? You know, we're storing this data. Is there any kind of financial, or is the state of Minnesota getting any money from the research groups for this? Are we taking any in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lohmer, we have arrangements with the Mayo Clinic for their services to test some of the specimens, dried blood specimens, for specific conditions that Mayo is specifically capable of testing and are the experts. We do not share the dried blood spots or have them stored at any external facility unless under a specific agreement that we have contracted with another entity. There are very few of those that we have done, and the state does not financially benefit from that arrangement.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I assume that we're going to probably be hearing a lot more about this, if not in this committee, then maybe in Representative Gottwald's committee. But if we're going to get information on the cost of storing the blood and all of that, I think it would be fair to also at the same time have information about the savings from discovering the diseases early and saving the children from a lifetime of disability, or the cost of medical care, oftentimes probably to the MA program of dealing with severe and sometimes lethal diseases that these children would otherwise have that are prevented from this program. So if we're going to be looking, you know, I think it's important that we see the whole picture if we're going to see a little slice of the picture. So, you know, maybe, Mr. Chair, if we're going to have some kind of hearing on this, we could have it all then. But I just want to put that out there that we not look at it just in isolation, because I know, you know, this program fairly well, and, you know, it's had spectacular results for families and children, and probably I have no idea how much money has been saved if you just want to look at it on the financial level alone, but it's got to be huge.
Chair, Representative Liebling, thank you. We will prepare a comprehensive set of information about the program.
Representative Ellinger. Huntley, Commissioner Ellen.
Members of the committee. This is part of the core public health function, and with the surveillance and monitoring and intervention appropriately for prevention, I agree there's lots of discussion, and we'd be glad to have that, because I think it is a wonderful program that is really serves the needs of the state.
And I just have to comment, there is a member of the state legislature who had a son. Not the DNA one, but they did find that his child had a genetic problem that could be fixed simply by changing the kid's diet, and the kid is doing very well.
Thank you.
McElfacker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask, due to the previous two questions, what specific diseases are you testing for? Are we given that information? How many? What are they? Is that information that's available to the public?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, it's 54 conditions that are tested for, and I believe we can get a list.
And hearing screening.
So 54 conditions plus hearing screening, and we can provide a list. So I can't rattle off the top of my head.
Okay.
Last set. Mr. Chair, the final area of the department is the administrative support services area. About 81% of the funding in this area is statutorily appropriated. About 19% is directly appropriated. The largest statutory appropriation is the Miscellaneous Special Revenue Fund. This is where the department operates its indirect cost program, where and houses services such as finance, facilities, human resources, information systems and technology management, planning, policy development, government relations, and leases. The federal funds included in this slide are temporarily housed here just part of a technical budget mechanism, but eventually they will get allocated to programs, so they aren't really part of this area. And then the general fund piece of the pie is 100% for leases. So looking at how much is for MDH-based activities and how much is for grants, the 1% amount here is a part of that federal slice of the pie, so it doesn't really reside here and will be allocated out to program for management. The rest is all MDH-based activities for those items I mentioned. And finally, looking at just the general fund, 100% is for building leases. This is a portion of our building leases funded out of the general fund, and the balance is funded through our indirect cost program.
Okay. Questions for Ms. Julek? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Julek? Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Julek? I'm one of the new freshmen that Chairman Huntley was speaking of, so still learning the ropes and the protocol. Thank you, Representative Gottwald. Commissioner, how do you do? Prior to this, I was served on the City of Delano as the mayor, and in 2010, of course, every year we do our budget. Knowing that we had an expected revenue shortage and a spending situation, we had only $780,000 to cut, so it's nothing now compared to the state. But anyway, our various departments came in and presented with us their capital improvements and their budgets and what they could do to help out our little city of Delano, as is the case for all 19B. The rest of the mayors shared that with me. So I'm just curious, and I hope that you're the correct person, Ms. Julek, as the CFO, that this question is, and certainly if the answer's not today, you can get back to me. But just curious, knowing that for the full year that the state would have a budget deficit, a huge problem, a hemorrhaging, if you would, were you able to go to your various departments and all the programs that you shared with us today and come together with a solution or areas in which you could trim or find improvements or help contribute to the lessening of our deficit? I've just been presented with over $1 billion worth of programs, and as the CFO, I would imagine perhaps it's in your position to ensure that all these programs are running very efficiently, and knowing there's a deficit, that there's areas that we need to trim. So that's the question. Have you had the opportunity to do that and go through your departments and ask what they can bring to the table to help trim the budget?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, every agency has a process that does that. It's working in conjunction with the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget, coordinating with them, coordinating with the governor's office, coordinating internally with our divisions, and coming up with our internal process. Every agency has that process to do just that. So, yes, that does occur.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. McDonald.
Ms. Julek, so have you presented then to the commissioner, although it's only 3 weeks, areas in which you can lessen your budget in the different programs? Improvements, if you will?
Mr. Akam, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Craig Akam. I'm the Assistant Commissioner over Finance Administration for the department. To your question, Representative, certainly the commissioner is aware of discussions that we're having to reduce costs in conjunction with the formulation on a statewide basis of the governor's budget, which will be released on February 15th. But I would say that as an agency, we've been working to, you know, streamline, find efficiencies, improve the quality and outcomes of our programs, reduce costs, because we know that we're in this situation. And we've been utilizing processes in the department, both auditing processes, both process improvement processes, and in fact, our agency and others have been using the lean process out of federal, out of the private sector, to look for ways to streamline some of these programs. And so I would say that we've been working very diligently and very hard to be able to deliver the most program with the dollars we have.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And just to help Representative McDonald and others, right now, when he goes back to his office, probably the commissioner is going to be working on looking at various things. On the 15th of November of February, the governor must release his budget to us. It'll be a comprehensive budget. It'll be this thick of pages in the different accounts, talking about revenue, spending, and they will, by virtue of how they choose to raise and spend money, give us a comprehensive budget. That budget will be presented to the various committees on the relevant topics. We'll be hearing both from DHS and this group again as they present their recommendations to us. And then we'll have then a month and a half or so to respond with our own budget and our own spending and revenues, et cetera. So some of those ideas that you've heard them talking about, lean, and that they might not do quite so much of, will be presented in probably about 3 weeks to us.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for whoever can answer this question. I think it's also important to know what we've done in the past, too. So I was wondering if anybody could let us know what actions or what reductions have been done in the last two biennials.
Mr. Chair, I think our time goes back one biennium between the two of us. I can maybe go back 3 years. I think over the last 3 years, the department has received about 18% administrative reductions. That's going back to the 2008 session. Just in the last 2 years, it's been about 13% administrative reductions. Grant reductions in the last 2 years, I think there's a lead-based grant that was eliminated from the department. I'm not sure about 2008.
I believe it was about 1 or 2% across the board.
1.8% reduction in 2008 for all grants was implemented. But we can maybe put together a summary.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just, Representative Abler, thank you for giving that explanation. I just wanted to sort of say a little bit more about that, because I think it's a great question from Representative McDonald, a very appropriate question. But what I want to add is to say that the reason that we have a certain process here that we normally go through, and the public doesn't always understand it, but the reason that the legislature tends to wait for the governor's budget is that we don't here have the information we need to really, in the first instance, decide what to do. So the people that are here testifying are the people who really understand what their functions are and are the ones who are most likely to be able to see which things are important, which things can be cut. And of course, they don't make the final decision on that. We do, but or we do with the governor. But that's why it's important to let the governor come forward with a budget so we can at least see what he's proposing and then have the testimony about those various items and try to then make some come to some conclusions that are the most beneficial for the state. So, you know, I think it's a positive thing to me that you're asking the department what do they think, because I think that's what we indeed want to do here. We want to find out where they think cuts can reasonably be made or what their priorities are, and then we proceed based upon that information.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd also like to know what are the results from all these programs. What are the outcomes? You know, I served on the Environment Committee the last legislative session, and the chair, to her credit, she was really driven by results-based budgeting and outcomes. And when we're talking about these programs and all these programs, I want to know what results that we've seen, whether it's dealing with childhood pregnancy, et cetera. And then when we're talking about the decrease in funding, did the results did we also see an impact on the results as well? And my point is, if we had a reduction in funding to these programs, but yet we were still able to achieve positive results, or if they took a dip after that. So we don't need to know that information today, but eventually, again, I want to know the results and take a look at the results-based budgeting.
Okay. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I would just, maybe at the risk of overstating the obvious, first of all, no question is a dumb question, and I'm glad that Representative McDonald and others are asking some of these questions, and I'm sure Dr. Ellinger wants to be able to provide answers too. How much are we spending? How much have we cut? How much are we planning to cut? What are the results for the spending or the cuts? That's really what we need to be discussing a lot in this committee. So I hope we're open to a lot of different questions, even if we find them somewhat uncomfortable from time to time. The other point I want to make to what Representative Liebling was saying is I think, again, this is fairly obvious to most of us who've served here, that it is the legislature's responsibility to pass a balanced budget. Let me repeat that. It is the legislature's responsibility to pass a balanced budget. What the governor brings us in mid-February is a proposal. It's an important proposal. I don't want to minimize that. But we are already abundantly aware that we are way behind the eight ball financially, that we have a $6.2 billion budget deficit. And it is appropriate for the Finance Committee of this area within the legislature that has the responsibility for passing a balanced budget to begin putting those ideas together. Now, we can certainly look at where we line up or don't line up with the governor's budget when it comes forward, but to wait for the governor's proposal and then react to it, I think is, I would just disagree with that. I think we are perfectly within our rights and our powers and responsibility to begin working on that just as soon as possible. I know my constituents, the people I've talked to, both in my district and elsewhere, really want to see us get down to work this this session and get our work done early. And our biggest work is to balance this budget and do it in a way that helps create jobs and move Minnesota forward. So I would respectfully disagree. I think we can go ahead and do it now. Sooner the better.
We're don't have too much time left, so we have more people to testify. So, Ms. Julek, are you done?
Mr. Chair, I am, and I believe the Commissioner would just like to wrap this part of the presentation up.
Okay. Representative Huntley, members of the committee, as you can see, we have a complex budget. We have multiple sources of funds. We have lots of activities that go on. And really all of these, as I pointed out initially, really focus on what can we do to prevent illness and injury and disease in the state? How can we intervene in an appropriate fashion? How can we rehabilitate those who have problems? We look at both the are involved in both the medical care side and the public health side, all with the idea of bringing medicine and public health together so that we can assure a strong health system and a healthy population in Minnesota. So thank you for this opportunity to come before you today.
Thank you. And next we're having Mr. Golden. Welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden. I am the director for the Division of Health Policy at the Department of Health. Chairman Abler had asked for some additional information about some select programs, and so we have prepared some materials for that. I have with me Diane Rydrick, the assistant director for the Division of Health Policy, and she will be talking about Merck. So with that.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm going to provide a little bit of background on the Merck program, the Medical Education and Research Costs Program, a little bit of the history and timeline, and some more detail about how these funds are distributed. As Ms. Julek mentioned, this is one of the largest pools of money within the Health Policy Division. It first appeared as an entity in the form of a study back in 1993. The legislature at that time directed MDH to study medical education costs, determine how costs should be allocated across the healthcare system, and then develop a method for allocating those costs and allocating that revenue across providers of graduate medical education and graduate healthcare professions education. That study led to the formation of a task force, which led to the establishment of the Merck Trust Fund in 1996, and an advisory committee, which continues today with many of the same people involved 15 years later. Merck was first funded in 1997, and the first distribution of Merck funds went out in 1998. It was a distribution of roughly $18 million, $5 million from the general fund, $3.5 million from the access fund, and then about $9 million in Medicaid matching funds. In 2000, Minnesota received a federal waiver from CMS to begin carving out the medical education add-on funds from the PMAP program. Ms. Julick did mention this in her presentation. This is the largest source of funds in the Merck pool at this point. This took place in 2000, and for several years thereafter was distributed as a separate pot of funds, but I'll describe that in a little bit more detail later. Next slide. When Merck was established, it was explicitly set up as a mechanism for offsetting lost patient care revenue for clinical teaching sites, clinical education sites that were facing increased competition and a higher cost structure. So for those who are not familiar with what the structure of a medical residency program might look like, or a clinical training program for advanced practice nurses or others, there are often extra costs associated with providing that training. With residency programs, you have salaries that are paid to residents. You might have on-call rooms or extra space, extra infrastructure needs for them. And then there are some costs that are a little bit harder to define related to new residents or students who might order more tests, might take a little bit more time to see patients than a more established physician or nurse might. And then, of course, there are the oversight costs of the preceptor who is overseeing that student or resident while they're getting their training. So Merck was established to offset that higher cost structure. In practice, there was no real way to know what the cost structure was in any individual facility or whether they were facing increased competition, so Merck was set up to distribute funds to all clinical training sites. Just in terms of quickly underlying principles of Merck, really the main principle was that having a strong workforce, a strong graduate medical education and health professions education system is a benefit to all of Minnesota, not just to the hospitals or other sites where that training is provided. Given that it's a benefit to all Minnesotans, the costs for that training should be shared across the healthcare system. The money was set up to follow the training. It doesn't follow the individual student, but it goes to the sites where those students receive training. So even back 15 years ago, and increasingly now, that is in outpatient sites. A generation or two ago, most training for residents and students would have taken place in hospitals, along with the vast majority of care. As care has shifted to more outpatient settings, it's important that the clinical training follows that. Another underlying principle was that the health workforce pipeline should support cost, access, and quality goals and should incent the training of generalists, a diverse workforce, and address issues related to geographic distribution of providers. Next one. Just briefly, eligibility of Merck. Merck is set up to provide grants to sites that provide clinical education for physicians, so that's medical residents and medical students who are doing their clinical training, pharmacy students and residents, dental students and residents, chiropractic students, advanced practice nurses, and physician assisting students. To be eligible for Merck, a site has to be a site where patient care is taking place. They have to be funded by patient care revenues, at least in part, and they must be a currently active Medicaid site. It is supposed to take place in settings that face increased financial pressure as a result of competition with non-teaching entities, although that's certainly difficult to measure, and should emphasize primary care or specialties that are in undersupply. To give a sense of the size of Merck and how much has been distributed over the years, oh, is there a question?
Oh, Representative Fritz.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. On the geographical areas, have you any information on that? You know, I have the South Central College that has a nursing program, and I've asked this in the past. And I really never received an answer whether or not we received those funds or are eligible for those funds. And I wondered how far out, that it goes. Because you do cover nursing in the advanced practice nurse and the other specialties that I believe we have or hope to have soon in Southern Minnesota. Could you get that information for me?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Fritz. We would be able to get that information if there's a specific site that you're looking for. In general, if any facility, a clinic, a hospital, nursing homes aren't eligible, but pharmacies, other types of sites, if they have students in an advanced practice nursing program that are doing even a small amount of their clinical training there, they would be eligible for Merck as long as it is a site that accepts Medicaid patients. But if there's a specific site, we can certainly get that information for you. So again, since Merck was first distributed in 1998, we have distributed roughly $500 million to clinical sites all around the state. The structure of the program, as you'll see in a moment, there are hundreds of sites that are part of Merck each year. It would be administratively difficult to give grants to each of those sites individually. So the funds flow through sponsoring institutions, which are institutions like the Academic Health Center or Mayo Clinic that sponsor multiple programs that have training sites. So the funds flow through 20 or so large sponsoring institutions. They are required to make payments to those clinical training sites within 60 days of when the funds are awarded. For the clinical training sites, it is essentially no strings attached for them. They can use that funding in any way that they see fit. The statute does not direct them to use it to offset any particular type of their training costs within their site. Many programs do use these funds to encourage sites to take on trainees. So particularly in some rural areas, if students in a particular program need to have experience in a small rural clinic, or in a pharmacy, the hope is that Merck funds can be used to provide an incentive for students to go to that site and for the training site to take on students and incur that higher cost. Next slide. Just very briefly, I know that Merck gets technical very quickly, so I'll give a high-level overview of how the funds are distributed. Merck is formula-based, and the formula has changed over time. One thing that I think is important to understand about Merck is that there has always been some tension around what the appropriate way is to distribute these funds. These are Medicaid dollars, but they are intended to support clinical training. So from the inception of Merck, there has always been some back and forth about whether it should be distributed based on Medicaid volume, because it is Medicaid money, or whether it should be distributed based on those higher costs that teaching sites face, because it is intended for education. That PMAP carve-out is a medical education add-on fund that was part of PMAP. When Merck was first established in 1998, the formula was based solely on the cost of training. So if a site had more trainees, more students or residents, and particularly if they were the more expensive ones, like medical residents, they would receive a larger Merck grant. The PMAP pool, which started in 2001, essentially split the difference between those two viewpoints. It had a formula that weighted grants 50% based on the cost of training and 50% on the amount of volume that the amount of Medicaid volume that that particular site had compared with other sites in the distribution. So if a site had 1% of the revenue of all the clinical training sites, they would get 1% of the grant. Those two pools were combined into a single pool in 2004. Seeing that it became a 67-33 formula probably looks a little unusual, but that was really the status quo. It was looking at how much money had been distributed under each formula previously. For a time, there was a cutoff so that small sites, those that had only a very small number of FTEs in a year, were not eligible. That was an attempt to ease the administrative burden for sites or for sponsoring institutions that had to award a number of very small grants. There was also, during that time period, a 10% discretionary fund, which meant that of the total grant that a particular sponsoring institution got, they could give out 10% of it to the sites of their choice, to eligible sites of their choice, so they could provide an incentive to train in certain areas. The most recent change to the formula happened in 2007. It now is based 100% on Medicaid volume. So the larger Medicaid sites get a larger portion of the grant, and there is no longer that connection to the cost of training. The largest sites within the distribution, those that have more than roughly 1% of the PMAP revenue across all sites, get a 20% bonus on their grant as well. Ms. Julek also mentioned there are several direct payments that also became part of Merck at that time. They total just over $5 million a year, and they're made to the Academic Health Center, to the University of Minnesota Medical Center Fairview, and to the U of M Dental School. To give a better sense of how the funds actually go out around the state, as I mentioned, there are several hundred sites in any given year. In the most recent distribution, which went out last month, there were 635 distinct sites all around the state that received Merck funding. And I'll have another slide that shows a little bit more of what the range of grants is. 85% of that funding went to hospitals. That's where the bulk of the trainees are, but not all. 9% of the Merck distribution in 2010 went to physician clinics. 23% of the FTE trainees around the state were in physician clinics, and 77 were in hospitals. 70% of the total pool went to facilities in Hennepin and Ramsey counties. They train 54% of the FTEs. The chart at the bottom of this slide just gives a bit of an overview of how the funding is distributed to the counties that receive the largest grants in the state. I presented these 3 years only because they show a little bit more what the evolution of the formula looks like and how that has changed the distribution around the state a little bit. So the columns in the chart are the percentage of the grant, so the percentage of the total pool that went to a particular county in any given year, and then the percentage of the eligible students and residents who were being trained in that county in that year.
If I could just, since I know a little bit about this one, you know, you may look at Hennepin County and say, oh, they're getting way too much money geographically, but well over half of the physicians in this state got at least part of their training at Hennepin County Medical Center. Mm-hmm. So, and that's what this money is aimed at, is basically the training. So, while Hennepin County gets a lot of money in this way, there's heavy, huge expense because most of the physicians are getting some of their training there.
Yes, Mr. Chair, yes. Several of the largest teaching hospitals in the state are in Hennepin County or in Ramsey County, including not just HCMC, but also the UMMC Fairview is another one of the larger teaching hospitals. And again, in most cases, you'll see there's a pretty close match between the percentage of the money that went to each county and the percentage of FTEs that were in the county. The only exception there is Olmsted County, which just because of the nature of the way the formula works, they train a high percentage of FTEs, but a smaller percentage of the grant goes to Olmsted County. Again, just to give you a sense of the shape of the distribution, most of the funding goes to 20 large sites, all hospitals. Those sites receive three-quarters of the distribution, which is a little bit higher than it was a few years ago, but it has always been fairly highly concentrated with a small number of sites. They have a high number of FTEs, and they have generally high Medicaid volume. There is also an increasing concentration at the lower end of the distribution. In 2010, we had about 20% of those 600-plus sites that got less than $1,000, and 12% got less than $500. Just as a point of interest, the smallest grant in 2010 was 14 cents to one site. The largest sites in 2010, these are generally the largest sites in any given year. Once you get down to 6 through 10, 10 through 20, they can shift a little bit. But over the years, the largest recipients of Merck have traditionally been HCMC, University of Minnesota Fairview, Regions, Children's, and St. Mary's, with some exceptions. So, again, the largest grant in 2010 was nearly $9 million to HCMC. The final column on the right just is another way of looking at the way that the grants are distributed. It's a grant per FTE. And the next slide might actually show that a little bit better. We just wanted to give a little sense of some of the variations in the formula. This is actually data from 2009 on the last slide, showing a selection of sites at the high end and the low end of the distribution. We had some large grants going to sites that have not very many FTEs. Site A, 0.39 FTEs with a grant of nearly $1 million. That's effectively a grant of $2.4 million per FTE. At the low end is a site with nearly 16 FTEs and a grant of approximately $1. So again, it's just an effect of the distribution when it's not tied to costs of training. You sometimes end up with some of those quirks in how the funds are distributed.
Representative Gottwald. And by the way, we're going to skip the next two for today and get them later. That's the e-health and the peer grouping.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, this is very good information. I appreciate having it. The FTE is per employee, correct, within the health system, if you will.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, yes, it's an FTE within that training program, so a full-time student or a full-time resident.
Mr. Chair, and again to our testifier, if you don't have this information now, that's fine. I mean, it'd be nice to know it at some point, but it'd be interesting to know how much money we're spending per, you know, I don't know if you can say per doctor or per healthcare provider we turn out of the program, if you will, you know, kind of a cost per outcome kind of measure. I assume you do some of that kind of stuff, but if we could see that at some point, that'd be kind of neat to see.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, do you mean the cost to produce a physician, to total cost to produce?
The analysis, Mr. Chair, to the testifier again, the analysis I'm looking for would be interested in is, you know, for the dollar we're spending in an organization, what are we getting out of that? Because obviously there's a public good we're trying to achieve with that money. And I don't know if there's a way to accurately measure that or not, because I think, you know, maybe the point you're trying to get at is Merck does not fund the entire cost of training one physician. It's a part of the equation. But, you know, it'd be nice to know, you know, what is this helping us accomplish in the way of training, you know, our workforce, if you will, for healthcare delivery in Minnesota.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, we can certainly look into that. I think some of the information we have on that is more anecdotal, hearing from sites that receive Merck funds about what the value, literally and figuratively, is to them of having funds and the ways in which they use it to further their efforts. We can certainly look at that.
And, Mr. Redditch, I would also like to know the how you do what tilt there is towards primary care versus some of the specialists.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Right now the formula does not provide any extra weight or any additional funding to any particular type of provider. Over the years that Merck has been in place, excuse me, there have been some discussions about that. In the earlier years of the program, the determination was made that at that point we didn't feel we had good enough data to allow us to be responsive through Merck to shortage areas geographically or specialties. That may have changed in the intervening years, but currently the formula looks only at MA volume and not at the types of providers that are being trained.
And so that's why St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester is, although they have a large FTE, they do not get as much money as you might think, and because they don't do a lot of MA.
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. As I've mentioned, the formula has changed quite a bit over time, and it has always been a point of very legitimate dispute whether it is intended to support Medicaid volume or clinical education costs. And as the formula has changed, it has had some implications, positive and negative, for different training sites.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Just a final announcement before you adjourn. Next week, if you're on a plan, Tuesday we'll be talking about the OLA report about special transportation, the long-awaited one. Wednesday we'll be talking about non-emergency, whatever, that thing that we've talked about so much. And Wednesday we'll be talking about PCAs and other things. And Thursday we'll be hearing from the CCDSs, and just to give you a flavor of what's going on. So, Mr. Chair,
Okay, well, take us out of here. I'd like to thank the Department of Health and their people for giving us this testimony. Very interesting. And with that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.